A very English Christmas present. Doctors and nurses take down Justin Bieber. It's Christmas Day on the World. I'm Marco Werman. We speak with one of the doctors from the UK choir that beat Bieber to the number one spot on the charts for Christmas Day.
I've got a whole new street cred from my little nephews and my niece. I'm like, yeah, oh, Bieber just, you know, tweeted me, whatever.
And on the island of Lesbos in Greece, it's just another day. Thousands of refugees came ashore today. How the locals react?
They just help out. If it's at night, I saw numerous times that they would take people into the cafe to warm up, and then locals would go to a storeroom and bring clothing.
And helping the children of immigrants here speak the language of their grandparents. That's all today on The World. Today we've already seen a man with a white beard flying through the air and surprising many with his goodwill. Yeah, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi paid a surprise visit to longtime rival Pakistan, the first such visit in a decade. And elsewhere, another Christmas metaphor, as in no room in the inn for the out-of-towners. Thousands of Middle Eastern refugees landed on the Greek island of Lesbos today, as they have most days for the last few months. Gene Carstensen was on Lesbos for much of the year. It happened again today, Gene, and as you discovered when you were there, the welcome on this little Greek island is pretty warm because many of these Greeks were refugees themselves, right?
It's absolutely true. I got to be friends with a Greek journalist who was born on the island, Stratis Balaskas, and he told me his father came as a refugee when he was only 6 years old. He was orphaned over in Turkey during the Greco-Turkish War, and he was put into a refugee boat, and he arrived to Lesbos. He told me that many people on the island have stories like that. So you really have descendants of refugees meeting this current generation of refugees.
You spent a lot of time on the island, not just this year, but in past years. Is there a limit, do you think, to the generosity? I mean, how long can an island like Lesbos keep out the welcome mat?
Well, I think that these are very kind people, and I think that kindness will last a long time. But there are stress points, and that has to do with the resources on the island. You know, Greece is in a crisis. Their healthcare system, for example, is under incredible stress, and there's only 4 ambulances on that island to begin with. So these are the points where I see that there could be stress over time as the locals feel that their resources aren't even taking care of their own needs, and they're still having to tend to all these refugees that continue to arrive.
Maybe you can share with us a story that kind of indicates how committed the Greeks on Lesbos feel about the migrants.
Sure. What comes to mind is Skala Skamnia. It's a small village of only 140 people, and I would spend a lot of time there, as do many aid workers and journalists, because this is where a lot of the boats come in, and I saw many times the owners of the cafes there along this very small port, they just help out. So the Coast Guard brings in, rescues a boat, and the cafe, they take people in. If it's at night, I saw numerous times that they would take people into the cafe to warm up, and then locals would go to a storeroom and bring clothing. This is something that the international volunteers are doing, but also the locals are very involved in it as well.
Wow. 2015 was unprecedented with refugees. What are your big concerns for the year ahead with no end in sight to the war in Syria?
Well, exactly. There's no end in sight to the war in Syria, and that means this problem will continue. And already in Athens, we're seeing a lot of stress. Refugees are being sent back now from the border, and I think this is going to be very hard for Greece to deal with.
Reporter Gene Carstensen, thank you as always. Have a great year.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Those fine voices belong to the choir of the National Health Service in the UK. They managed to nab number one on the Christmas music charts there with their song, even beating Bieber. Pediatrician Kate Rogerson sings in the choir and helped organize this.
You know, we just wanted to really celebrate our national healthcare system over here in the UK. And, you know, we're a little hospital choir. We get together every Tuesday and we rehearse in our little choir. And we just really wanted to celebrate actually the roles that we have in the healthcare system. And we wanted to do a bit of a shout out to all those people that are on call today or on the night shift or the day shift who have been taken away from their families or even patients who are sick in hospital over Christmas. And we just wanted to make sure that the rest of the world communicated that we're thinking about those people today and just trying to be nice and Christmassy about it.
Right. I mean,
it's
I know
a celebration, basically.
A celebration. I mean, the NHS doesn't do this every year. So was there something, was there some pressure that the NHS felt this year that brought you around to this?
Yeah, this has been a challenging year for the national healthcare system. In these times of austerity, there's been lots of cuts. There's been potential changes to junior doctors' contracts. Our allied health professionals, such as nurses, have had their training bursaries cut. And I think people are quite fearful about the future of the National Health Service. It's something that we're incredibly proud of in this country. It really is something that we cherish, and the general public have completely shown us that today by backing us for the Christmas number one, which we've then gone on and got. And I've had the best thing about it is I've completely overwhelmed anyway, but I've had text messages from a couple of friends in hospital. So for example, one of my friends is a brain surgeon, a neurosurgeon, and he sent me a message saying he's just put a shunt into the brain of a little 17-month-old.
Wow.
And he's just come out of surgery and he's exhausted, and you know, and then to find out that the NHS is Christmas number one and actually everyone's thinking about the work that is being done today and the emergency work and all the rest of it. He said it's absolutely boosted him. And that's exactly what we were going for. Even the Bieber got behind us.
Right. You beat Justin Bieber for the number one spot in the UK.
I think Americans... my personal account.
Oh, really?
I've got a whole new street cred from my little nephews and my niece. I'm like, yeah, oh, Bieber just, you know, tweeted me, whatever.
I mean, number one on the charts in the US is important, but I think, I'm not sure Americans will get this, that number one in the UK at Christmas time is such a sign of prestige. What was your reaction when you heard this?
I'm from the north of England. I'm from Yorkshire, where we're slightly awkward. Kind of picture Hugh Grant in all of his movies. So I did my kind of awkward grunting noise. No, it was the best feeling in the world. What can I say? I'm just so grateful.
Dr. Kate Rogerson, a children's doctor in the UK, among the doctors, nurses, and health providers who sang in the NHS choir and hit number one on the British charts. Kate, thank you very much and happy holidays.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So we're going a little rogue for the rest of today's show. We've got a World in Words showcase coming up for you, a selection of stories from our language podcast. First, here's Patrick Cox, host of The World in Words, with a present-day tale of how we speak about the past.
Here's a joke. Vincent van Gogh walks into a bar. Wait a minute. Vincent van Gogh's dead. Shouldn't it be walked into a bar? Ah, it's just a joke, right? We do it all the time with jokes. But increasingly, we do it with other stuff, too. Historians do it. The first time I noticed hearing it in person was about a dozen years ago when I interviewed Marion Smith. She's the in-house historian with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. I was asking her about the U.S. Border Patrol and its use of horses. Here's what she told me.
Horses were the traditional tool used by the Border Patrol along the border. Certainly, they were more widely used earlier in the 20th century, not only because the Border Patrolmen are working in remote areas and all, but because there is not...
Did you hear that? She started off in the past tense.
Horses were the traditional tool.
She stuck with the past tense for just one more sentence, then boom, we're in the present tense.
Not only because the Border Patrolmen are working in remote areas and all, but because there is not...
Smith continued.
As time goes on...
Time goes on? In what? Some kind of suspended, ever-present state?
As time goes on and the Border Patrol adopts different technology, they've wanted to move from horses to, like, jeeps after World War II. But they still found, at times, that technology didn't always do it. They had to have the horses.
Now, this was the point at which I got really confused. We were back in the past tense, where we'd started. As I later discovered, this is a popular way for historians to relate past events, use a frame of the past tense at the beginning and end of the story, but in the middle, switch to the present, or as it's often referred to, the historical present. Now, as someone who talks on the radio and in podcasts, I must confess to using the present tense a lot to describe the past. But not the distant past, the World War II past. That, to my ears, is jarring. Not everyone thinks so. Here's Kate Williams, a historian at Royal Holloway, University of London.
I feel that as historians, we're always trying to encourage people to enjoy the past and think carefully about the past. And I think the present tense is a very important tool we can use it for, because if we don't think about what happened in the past, if we don't think about how it could impact on us now, we will make the same mistakes.
It's a technique borrowed from, well, jokes, as well as old newsreel films and poetry and fiction. Fair enough. But this is history. And I know it isn't merely a sequence of events, but don't historians have a responsibility to tell history and acknowledge a certain pastness of past events? Writer and translator Miranda France would like them to do a bit more of that.
They start talking in the present and then they can't sort of reflect all those differences in time. And so they then switch and go back into the past. So you're constantly readjusting to try to understand where you are. It's like looking at a painting where no perspective has been used and everything is on the same plane.
Now, French and Spanish, and maybe some other languages too, do use the historical present more than us, and more formally in writing as well as speech. And it's possible that English may follow suit if historians continue to tell us that Paul Revere rides to Lexington, or Hillary Clinton becomes America's first female president. Wait, there's something wrong there. But if history increasingly has the appearance of being in the present, will it affect how we think about it?
I really don't think it's going to change our perception of the past.
This is Ben Yagoda, a language blogger and author most recently of The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. He first complained about the historical present in a New York Times essay in 1986.
I was a little harsher then.
He wrote that too many people, fiction writers he was talking about then, too many people were using the technique without understanding the underpinnings. Yagoda says for historians, it comes from the same urge to grasp unthinkingly for the immediacy of the present tense.
In their speech and their presentation, it shows that historians, like the rest of us, are prone to cliché and vogue modes of presentation. They're not immune. But I don't think that it has a deeper meaning in relation to our understanding of history.
So maybe we're safe. We still understand the past to be the past, even when it's in the present. Vincent van Gogh is still dead. Oh yeah, the joke. I never told the punchline. Okay, Vincent van Gogh walks into a bar. Barman says, "You want a drink?" Vince replies, "Nah, I've got one here." For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
And Patrick will be back in a couple of minutes in the future with A Tale of Two Languages. But before the break, another one of our favorite releases of 2015.
Boom, boom, boom. Ah, ah, ah. Boom, boom, boom.
This is from a smoking collection put out this year from the golden age of dance music in Senegal. It's called Senegal 70, 1970, the vintage of the songs here. This is one of those great bands that was always doing live gigs in Dakar. King Ngom et les Perles Noires, the Black Pearls, and their tune Viva Marvillas. Imagine it's a sultry night along the Atlantic Ocean and you and your partner are moving your hips to an Afro Mambo like this. Yeah, that's from the fantastic collection Senegal 70. All of our favorite music picks from 2015 are at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. And with me in the studio for the rest of today's Christmas edition of the show are Nina Porzucchi along with Patrick Cox. They host our podcast about language, The World in Words. Hey, guys.
Hey, Marco. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. And Patrick, introduce us to this next story.
Well, I came across this at a conference. There was a professor, his name is Robert Train. He was doing a presentation on Spanglish in the 19th century.
Right, Spanglish being that fusion of Spanish and English.
And it's something that we think of as being very much late 20th, early 21st century.
Right.
So I thought, 19th century, that's interesting. And his research was all in Southern California. So I turned to Nina.
Yep, I'm actually from Southern California, and I spent the day with Robert Train going around parts of Los Angeles looking for clues to this early history of Spanglish.
All right, let's listen to that story, Nina.
To truly explore the early roots of Spanglish, we have to go back to the dawn of the dawns.
San Gabriel, 1837.
California, in the early 19th century, when Los Angeles was simply known as the Little Pueblo, and Alta California, as it was called then, was still a part of Mexico.
Buenas noches, señoras y señores. Tonight's story is the romantic story of a young Scotch adventurer who fell in love with California and with one of her beautiful daughters.
That Scottish adventurer was Hugh Reid. He's also the subject of this 1940s radio doc. But in the 1830s, he left the old world for the new, Mexico. And in his adopted home, he was rechristened with an additional Spanish name, Perfecto Hugo Reid. Reid would eventually settle on a ranch in Southern California near the San Gabriel Mission, in what's now Arcadia, a suburb of L.A.
It's a tale rich in the romance of the rancho.
Robert Train is a professor of Spanish at Sonoma State University. I met him in the Huntington Library Archives in Pasadena, where he spent the last few years making pilgrimages to read the extremely yellowed letters of Hugo Reid.
Whoa. I'm surprised you could even read these. They're so faint.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Did it take a long time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Reid was writing to a man called Abel Stearns.
Abel Stearns, Esquire. Pueblo. Referring to Pueblo, the city of Los Angeles. My dear sir, we arrived here after a pleasant journey on the 12th May.
Stearns was another gringo. Yes, that was the term around that time. Living in Alta California. He had immigrated from Massachusetts, and he had also become a Mexican citizen. Their letters detail daily life in early California. Reid tells Stearns about his recent trip around other parts of Mexico. It's a pretty ordinary letter at first reading, except listen closely.
To allow the doctor, it's referring to Dr. Keith, the man he was traveling to Mexico with, a little descanso.
Catch that word? Descanso. That's the Spanish word for rest. Hugo Reid wrote to Abel Stearns in Spanglish. Letters upon letters in Spanglish. And that's not to say that he couldn't write strictly in Spanish or strictly in English. He could, and he did. Train has plenty of examples of those. But often the Scotsman chose to use both at once, doing what Train calls code switching.
He knew how to say, take a little rest, but he's going beyond sort of the basic sort of communicational level of communicating information, which he could have done easily in English. Instead, he's choosing the Spanish word descanso.
Both Reid and Stearns married native Spanish speakers. Historians don't know for sure, but they assume they spoke Spanish inside their homes. And Reid's correspondence reflects a sort of back and forth, the Spanish words often keying into domestic affairs, like requests from Reid to buy cloth from Abel Stearns' store. Stearns was a merchant. He's credited for starting the port in San Pedro. Of course, they called it San Pedro back then.
Hugo Reid writes, "The old woman requires for the house a piece of percala. Si no hay percala, send her pura manta blanca. I remain, my dear sir, yours truly, Perfecto Hugo Reid."
Percala is a type of cloth called percal, and manta blanca is coarse cotton. But the most curious part of the exchange is not Reid ordering fabric for his wife in Spanish, but what he calls his wife in English, the old woman. It's a direct translation, says Train, of how men in Alta California might have referred to their wives in Spanish. La vieja, the old woman. Okay, so what's the big deal? A few native English speakers spoke Spanglish to each other way back when. What's this have to do with anything today? Simple. Hugo Reid's letters are reminders that California was, is, has always been a multilingual place. In fact, when California became a state in 1850, the new constitution was written in both English and Spanish. And for many years, California laws were written in both languages. But somewhere along the way, English usurped Spanish, and Spanish became, well, a foreign language.
So when you think of going to school in, like, Southern California now, in high school, I learned Spanish as a second language,
yes,
as a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny. Like,
well,
Spanish is a foreign language.
It would be funny if it weren't tragic.
Tragic and insidious. We left the Huntington Library to drive in Robert's rental car.
It even has that new car smell, right?
Yeah.
A few miles to the heart of Spanish and Spanglish-speaking Los Angeles, East L.A.
Amazing.
We turned on the radio to a Spanish language station, and right there on the dial,
it says FM 1 gives the time, and then foreign language.
Reading the signs as you drive down 3rd Street in East L.A., Spanish is far from a foreign language, but the real lingua franca is Spanglish.
So, if you look at the sign, it's King Taco, the best food in town. Burritos y tacos al pastor y carne asada. Park here.
And so we parked.
Un agua de horchata, por favor.
And ate.
Tamaño regular.
And I couldn't help but eavesdrop on the women sitting at the table next to us. Two young mothers, Desiree Cardenas and Brenda Padilla, and their toddlers. They're speaking Spanish and English and, yes, Spanglish.
Do you ever mix up the languages together?
I do, because we do speak both Spanish and English, so sometimes we'll be like, oh, can you get
stuff allá afuera.
Stuff allá afuera, like outside, but we'll be like, allá afuera. Like, it's just, it's become normal, I guess,
yeah,
to us.
Post-lunch, around the corner from King Taco, Robert and I make one final stop at the Calvary Cemetery. It's a beautiful old cemetery on a hill. Thousands of stone monuments commemorate the early residents of the Pueblo of Los Angeles. And the modern city, with her tall skyscrapers and her smoggy skies, can be seen in the distance. This is where Hugo Reed and Abel Stearns, these early Spanglish speakers, are buried, mere miles from where Spanglish continues to thrive today.
Not a bad place to land.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a, you know, but it's a whole, you know, I read this in part as a whole immigrant story, right? Sort of an unexpected one, maybe.
Hugo Reed died at the age of 42, just 2 years after Mexican Alta California became the 31st state of the Union. Incidentally, in his final days, he became obsessed with saving another language, the language of the Gabrielino Indians, the ancestral language of his wife, Doña Victoria. Sadly, that language has not survived.
All California mourns at the grave of Hugo Reed, a great pioneer and a great man.
For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi, Los Angeles.
And you can hear many more of Nina's stories in our podcast, The World in Words. Check it out on iTunes or go to pri.org/language. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Christmas and family, the warmth, the misunderstandings. Hey, talking to a grandparent about this is hard enough.
Yaya walked into my room in the morning and caught me in bed with a guy.
Now imagine they don't speak your language and you don't get theirs. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're showcasing some of our favorite language stories from the past year this Christmas Day, and I'm back with the hosts of our podcast, The World in Words. That'd be Nina Porzucchi and Patrick Cox. So was this the year that twerking officially entered the dictionary, or was that last year? Anyway, highlight some of the big moments of the past year, Patrick and Nina. From the perspective of language, what have been the most interesting stories you've come across for the podcast?
Well, we've been all over the world in the last year, and there
have
been
some great
stories. We had a reporter in Kenya following a group called Translators Without Borders. They're trying to set up a translation infrastructure in East Africa, mainly between English and Swahili. And they're translating things like doctor's notes, instructions on medications, that kind of thing.
I remember that story.
Nice twist on Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah, their feeling is that if they'd got in, for example, in West Africa with Ebola, they might have been able to have nipped that in the bud sooner had people who were infected with Ebola known what to do with the medication that they've been given. Mm. I went to Iceland and I did a couple of stories on the Icelandic language, on how when Icelanders come up with a new word, they actually go back to the sagas and they sort of recycle old words and give them new meaning.
The sagas are old folk tales, so they're going back to some really old words.
No Icelander, modern Icelander, would know what those words are. Mm. But they get recycled and they come to mean very modern things.
And from Iceland to halfway around the world, China. One of my favorite stories from this past year was a podcast that we actually worked on together. I went and reported in China. Patrick did the podcast. I was visiting the largest English language competition in the world, the finals that took place in Beijing.
Oh, that's right.
5 million kids competing in this foreign language, and a lot of them are better speakers than I am. It was amazing.
That is incredible.
And then finally, I think one of the more personal stories that really affected me this past year is a podcast that I did about dementia and bilingualism, which was about my own grandmother who speaks, she's a polyglot, she speaks 7 languages, and she has sort of lost them. She had a stroke a few years ago, and she is now suffering from dementia, and she speaks now a language that nobody in my family, or a combination of languages, I should say, that nobody in my family can quite understand. And we were looking at that podcast about talking to our grandparents. So it was a very personal story, and I was really happy to be able to produce it for the podcast.
Yeah, it was also a poignant story. Thanks for telling
Thanks.
That. The English language competition you were talking about in China, I mean, it occurs to me that kids mastering languages, that a lot of stories about language these days are about a language gap, parents trying to catch up with their kids who may speak a certain language better than them, quite often as immigration grows, as this kind of global human dynamic right now, yeah?
Yeah, there are language gaps everywhere with Nina right. and her grandmother. And indeed, we found another great story, which was from a Chinese-American producer, Yowei Shaw, whose grandparents don't speak English, and she does not speak Mandarin.
And it is one of my favorite stories of the year.
All right, here is Yowei Shaw.
I have a problem. As much as I want to, I can't communicate with my grandpa Ye Ye. He only speaks Mandarin Chinese, and I pretty much only speak English. So our conversations start simple and stay simple. I'll let my sister Yolan, who's in the same boat, demonstrate.
Ni hao, Ye Ye, which means, hello, grandpa. And then I go, Ni jin tian zan ma yang, which means, how are you doing today? He says, hen hao. Like, in this childish way, like you know, it's like a kid talking to him. So that means, very good. And then I say, oh, bu, oh. That means, are you hungry?
Is that it? Anything else?
Let's see. No, that's it.
And that's repeated every time you see him?
Yeah.
In the late 70s, my parents moved from Taiwan to the U.S., which is where I was born and grew up. Like any good second-generation immigrant daughter, I went to Chinese school and took classes in high school and college. But none of it worked. Even though my parents mainly spoke Chinese at home, I would almost always respond in English. Which is why, at age 27, I still have the Chinese vocabulary of a 3-year-old. So my grandpa Ye Ye and I stick to a basic script. In a lot of ways, we're strangers. I'm not sure why it's taken me so long to realize all of this, but I feel like a jerk. Growing up, Ye Ye was the best grandpa. He'd drive me to tennis lessons, teach me how to make dumplings, and cheer me on at piano recitals. I couldn't have been very good. He was the kind of grandpa who offered to take me to McDonald's after school, even if he'd just eaten himself. Considering our history, it's pretty ridiculous we've never had a real conversation. When I recently became aware of the situation, I decided I wanted to get past our language barrier. Ye Ye is 96. I wanted to try and get to know him before it was too late.
So, can you introduce yourself and say your name? And
I wish I could tell you I discovered a new app that helped me magically learn Chinese in time for this interview. But no, I took an old-fashioned shortcut.
I'm Chris Shaw. I'm a loyal husband and nice dad.
I got my dad to translate for his dad.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is I am jealous of my friends who are able to communicate no problem with their grandparents because they get to ask them lots of questions and they can communicate sophisticated things. Like they can talk about their work, their school, their love life, and also ask for advice. And, you know, I don't really get to do that with you.
Because of my age, and so I cannot hear that well. And also, when I heard a question, I have to process that in my brain. That process is also very slow.
We never got to my questions about how he met my grandma or what his biggest hopes and regrets are. Because we kept going around like this in circles. With each question I asked, Yaya kept responding with some version of, I'm too old.
Yeah, I think we should probably wrap up pretty soon, yeah.
Okay. Later, I debriefed with my dad.
I don't know, it just made me really sad. You know, I was looking forward to it, and it seems like it's too late. And I think not being able to speak the same language has also kind of masked how much Yaya has aged to me. I feel guilty about not having tried harder and, you know, not putting time and effort right now to trying to learn Chinese.
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't have to feel guilty about that.
But I do feel guilty. And it made me wonder if other people out there have the same problem as me. I posted the question on Facebook. And judging by the responses I got, it seems like there's kind of an epidemic among children of immigrants from all over the world.
A typical conversation doesn't last very long.
It's a lot of staring, looking at each other, smiling, nodding.
Have you eaten dinner yet?
I would try to ask her what she did that day, but I think she couldn't understand my accent.
Yes, we never really could have a full conversation.
It didn't even occur to me that that was weird.
Talking to other children of immigrants, what struck me most was just how bewildered everyone was. Why was this happening? Why do we put up with it?
Well, I think we don't have to put up with it.
I talked to this educational linguist, Nelson Flores, and what he said kind of blew my mind because it explained everything.
I think what happens sometimes is that children of immigrants have extra expectations on what their proficiencies in the home language should be. So they don't even try to make the effort because they have this kind of extra embarrassment that goes along with it.
In other words, a self-reinforcing vicious cycle.
But I always tell people that I talk to that are in similar situations that if you understand the language, then the language is already there inside of you. And it's just a matter of releasing it and letting it out.
Like, the power is within you.
Exactly. The power is within you if you believe.
The power may be within me, but time just isn't on my side. Even though I was bummed about my conversation with Yaya, I remembered I still had a chance to talk to my grandma Waipo, my mom's mom. She lives in Taiwan, and I don't get to see her much, which is why I sometimes forget about her. Luckily, my mom was in Taiwan recently, so I tried the parent as translator trick again.
Hey, Yowei.
While talking to Waipo on Skype.
Mommy, you have to translate everything she says.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I asked Waipo if she thought we had a communication problem. And the amazing thing was that she thought we had lame conversations, too.
I would ask, how are you doing? And, you know, recently, are you eating well? You know, things like that. I haven't really going to any serious conversation with you guys. I really feel very disappointed.
Aw, we feel the same way then. Here's kind of a big question. Do you feel like we really know each other? Like, do you think we really understand who each other is as a person?
我所了解的就是表面的。 I only know you from the outside appearance. As far as the deeper things, then I can understand. not really understand me from the inside.
My grandma and I clearly agreed about the issue. So now we just had to fix things by talking. But how do you get to know a stranger in just one conversation? And then it hit me. This was like a first date for Waipua and me. So I turned to the one place I had experience with for getting to know you date night questions.
What are six things you could never do without?
OkCupid, of course.
I like to spend time chatting with my friends over the phone or even visit them. And the second thing will be 看电视, okay, watch TV. The third one will be having sweets.
She could only come up with three, so we moved on to the next question.
What do you think you are really good at?
I feel that I'm very good at crafts, and I can do the 中国节, Chinese knots.
Traditional decorations you hang on the wall.
Oh, I'm looking at it right now in my living room. I had no idea that Waipua made that. Oh, can you tell her that I love it very much and I get lots of compliments? I actually had no idea she made it.
Then I asked Waipua if she wanted to know anything about me.
She wants to ask you, I want to ask you a very important question. Do you have a boyfriend and are you guys serious?
Yes, I have a boyfriend. We have been dating for about a year. Do you want to know more about him?
Waipua asked me what my type was, and I gave her my list of qualifications, which apparently satisfied her. Because after that, she didn't have any more questions for me.
Yeah. I think she's concerned about this and she now can rest in peace. She's very happy and contented.
I wanted to speak the same language as my grandparents because I thought they would somehow bear their souls to me and I would get to know them deep down to their core. Instead, the conversation with my grandma ended up being pretty mundane. And I loved every minute of it. As for my grandpa, even though we failed to have a real conversation, I realized this quest wasn't only about language. It was about the grandparent-kid relationship. We all grow out of it at some point. In my case, I just didn't have the language skills to start having grown-up conversations. And anyway, it's too late for that now with Ye Ye. I'll just have to find a new way to connect, without language. The way my grandpa did all those years when I was a kid. When I talked to my sisters for this story, there was one particular time when my grandpa really shined.
Ye-ye walked into my room in the morning and caught me in bed with a guy.
That's me telling the story.
Like just sleeping with my boyfriend at the time. This is in high school. I just remember being really shocked and I jump up and I like go to Ye Ye. And I can't say anything because I don't know how to I don't know how to make an excuse or lie. Which I later do to Daddy. But I don't know how to lie to Ye because I don't have good enough Chinese. And he just sort of looks at me. And he gives me a hug and says, I love you.
Oh my God.
That was it.
See, this is why. This is why maybe we don't need the language.
I really hope my sister Yolan is right. For the world, I'm Yo-Wei Shaw.
Yo-Wei Shaw is an independent radio producer in Philadelphia. She's also written an essay for us and included some great snapshots of her family. You can find all of that at PRI.org. And if you'd like to hear more stories about languages and the people who speak them, subscribe to the World in Words podcast at iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You won't miss a thing. More from Nina Porzuki and Patrick Cox of the World in Words coming up. And you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World, and a Merry Christmas to you.
Wait a minute, Marco. Isn't it Happy Christmas?
No, it's Merry Christmas.
Here it's Merry. It's happy
it's
over a little,
it's happy in England.
Anyway,
we're
as
merry
you can
over
hear,
here.
I'm back with Nina Porzucchi and Patrick Cox of our podcast, The World in Words. How are you guys going to wrap things up linguistically for us on this Christmas day?
Well, have you ever been to Hawaii?
Mele Kalikimaka.
Negative, I'm afraid to say. One day.
Well, for anybody who has, you know that it's a place of tremendous diversity, racial, linguistic, everything. You've got the people who first arrived, Polynesians, whose language evolved into Hawaiian. And then there are the more recent migrants, wave after wave of them, Japanese, Chinese, Filipinos, people from the American mainland.
But Marco, have you ever heard of the Russians of Hawaii?
I shouldn't be surprised, but no, I have not.
You shouldn't be surprised. A bunch of them landed there before it was a state more than a century ago, and it was just an American territory then.
And researchers at the University of Hawaii, that's still uncovering details of this largely forgotten chapter in American immigration history. And they recently put online a photo album of many of these Russians. And Alina Simone, who's a frequent contributor both to the podcast and to the broadcast, she knew about all of this before most of the rest of us did.
All right. If Alina is behind it, I can't wait to hear what she's got. Let's hear from Alina Simone.
4 years ago, I went on a Hawaiian vacation. No, I didn't go snorkeling. I spent nearly all my time in the bowels of a university archive, browsing 100-year-old newspapers. The truth is, I can only stand so much sand and sea. And when I happened to type two words into Google, Russians and Hawaii, I stumbled across a startling historical footnote. At the turn of the last century, the Hawaiian Board of Immigration imported more than 1,500 Russians, mostly from Siberia, to work the island's sugar plantations in a last-ditch effort to make Hawaii more white.
They had brought in Asian labor at first, Chinese and Japanese laborers.
This is Patricia Polanski, Russian bibliographer at University of Hawaii's Hamilton Library. Asian labor was the backbone of the early sugar industry, but it was a brutal way to make a living. In 1909, several thousand Japanese laborers went on strike, demanding better pay and working conditions, which worried plantation owners.
So they decided they wanted to try what we call haole labor or white labor.
A report issued by the Commissioner of Labor on Hawaii described local planters as, quote, willing without reserve to employ all the Caucasian workers the government can bring to the islands at a wage one-third larger than what was paid Asian laborers.
And when the plantation owners were looking around for white groups, there happened to be in Honolulu a man named Peril Strauss, who was a Russian kind of entrepreneur.
Kind of is kind of the key here. Peril Strauss drew up a recruitment brochure for the Russians, and according to Amir Hizimudinov, historian at Far Eastern Federal University in Khabarovsk, once Peril Strauss and his crew reached Russia,
they always make huge, huge propaganda. You need to come, we're doing for you big possibilities to work, good weather.
There were all kinds of things in there. They would be given a little house, how many hours they had to work, what their wages would be.
Siberians probably imagined they were traveling to an island paradise. Instead, they ended up in quarantine after measles broke out on their steamer. Their encampment on a Honolulu wharf became a tourist draw, while the newspapers made a circus out of the immigration snafu. According to Amir Hizimudinov, a large part of this was due to communication failure.
Language, it was really huge problem, very huge problem for Russians in Hawaii. They don't have interpreters.
There were so few Russian speakers in Hawaii, they recruited a local actress to help negotiate disputes, like one that broke out when the Russians tried bathing in the nude on a public beach. And there wasn't much cultural interpretation. Everything in Hawaii was totally alien to the Russians, from the local cuisine to the tropical weather. The Russians fled Hawaii in droves, many headed for California or New York. A few returned to Russia. But the story has another twist. Several years after the Russians first arrived in Hawaii, the Russian Revolution took place. That was 1917. And the new government headed by Vladimir Lenin wanted the Russians in Hawaii to come back home.
So Moscow sent a man here, whose name was Trautsholt, and his job, he had money. He was to pay their passage back to Russia, and he was to fill out their passport applications and everything. And that's what this album is that we have. We have the passport application album.
What Patricia Polansky is talking about here is a kind of scrapbook that Trautsholt compiled, filled with portraits and biographical sketches of the Russians who remained. Few people took Trautsholt up on his offer of free passage to war-torn communist Russia, but some who did never forgot Hawaii. Fast forward several decades to the collapse of the Soviet Union and...
One day I had a phone call from Catholic Charities, and they said, oh, there's a Russian woman here. And she was carrying an urn with her that had her mother's ashes in it. And it happened to be that her mother was born here in Hawaii, but her family had decided to repatriate to Soviet Union.
When her mother was on her deathbed, she told her daughter, I want to be buried in Hawaii.
And the minute the Soviet Union collapsed, she put herself on an airplane and showed up in Hawaii with her mother's ashes.
Not all their encounters with descendants have been this dramatic, of course, but once Patricia and Amir put the Russian passport album online, they began to connect even more families with the long-lost Russians of Hawaii.
We have been contacted by, I'd say, maybe 30 people that are descendants of people listed in the album.
It's funny to think what Hawaii might look like had the Russian immigration scheme succeeded. Would the islands be dotted with borscht stands today? Would balalaika jam bands be performing at the annual Island Arts Festival? These are questions you can spend an entire tropical vacation contemplating. But given this is a place where you can find sushi made from Spam, I doubt there's any influence Hawaii can't absorb. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
Yes, that is the Russian national anthem being played on a ukulele, courtesy of Bruce Spiegelmeier. And you can see photos from that Russian passport application album at PRI.org. You can listen also to the World in Words podcast there, or find it on iTunes and elsewhere. Thanks very much to Nina Porizuki and Patrick Cox for being with me today.
Mele kalikimaka to all of you out there and to everybody here in the studio.
Sheng deng kuai le, a very merry Chinese Christmas to you.
And I can't repeat that, but the same to both of you. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Season's greetings to all of you.
Public Radio International.